To share our experiences, but to share the struggles of our broader community in New York. So we thank you for staying here this afternoon and watching. We know the video is kind of long. But we're also interested in hearing from you. We've been visiting different neighborhoods this week, and we've been having community charlas in the evening, and we've heard from the dignified peoples of Los Angeles who are also fighting against gentrification. We've heard about how they're going about resisting, I'd like to hear from you what's happening here on the ground, if you're involved in any anti-gentrification struggles especially. It'd be great to hear what's happening in Los Angeles.
Yes, my name is Charlie, and I'm an inner city organizer working on issues of anti-gentrification organizing and also opposition to gang prevention. We have a whole network of people from Long Beach to all the way to Richmond Heights. I'm also very familiar with New York, which is interesting. I grew up in New York City. I lived in California. I've lived in New York for a year. I took note of the fact that we did not have any, I think, penetrating black community groups. You know, if you look at LGBT, Asian American, but who is? That's a problem in a lot of places where you don't have. Because I went to an anti-gentrification conference in Harlem, organized by Harlem tenant rights council. And there you didn't really have what you saw, the video I saw in the video, a lot of human community. So, someone who's grown up in New York, I'm well aware of like the polarization and segregation in New York City. And sometimes it's been reflected in the election in New York City in the far left movement. The female women voted for Clinton, the black women voted for Obama. I was in New York City last week discussing with Nance. I was trying to update some organizing taking place in LA. Some of my friends were active in New York City. So this is a problem in both cities, New York and LA, in terms of building bridges between the more U.S. oriented black, Puerto Rican, Chicago communities, and the Puerto Rican communities. And I had a dialogue with several members of the community the last few Thursdays on this issue. So it's really important what I'm saying is to build bridges among different communities. And one of the things we strive to do, and that I helped inform until 6, Southern California Urban Network, is to build those bridges, try to create a black Chicano alliance. And we brought in Chicanos to come to our rallies in black neighborhoods. And last year, I helped to bring several very prominent black community members to Chicago rallies. A lot of my upbringing in New York still stayed with me, particularly the segregation, division, particularly among black and brown.
Well, one of the primary objectives for Movement for Justice in El Barrio and coming to LA and visiting other cities we visited, New Haven, Connecticut, or Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, is to engage in these dialogues and to learn from each other. This past week, we visited downtown LA. We had dialogues in Boyle Heights. We had dialogues in South Los Angeles, and we were able to hear from the people about how they're struggling, and we believe it's essential to bridge these gaps that exist. Unfortunately, you know, our members weren't able to be here directly to speak for themselves as to what issues they're facing and to learn from everybody here in Los Angeles, but we felt It was important to be here, and we really appreciate the fact that we've been made welcome here in each community we've been in. And like the compañero says, it's true. It's a reality that there's a major need to build multiracial alliances, and we as an organization deliberately attempt to make those bridges, not just in East Harlem or New York City, but also here in Los Angeles. We, from the beginning, when we started the organization, we knew that this would emerge. These divisions that exist within our communities are at times deeply ingrained in our community. For example, we organize in privately owned buildings, not public housing, because right now we don't have the capacity to organize public housing in public housing. Therefore, the buildings we organize in are privately owned, and most of them, you know, are owned by this guy, Stephen Kessner, or were owned by Stephen Kessner. The makeup of our membership reflects the tenants who live in these buildings. The tenants who live in these buildings are immigrant, are for the most part undocumented, and are the majority Mexican. And that's reflective of our membership base. Yet at the same time, we recognize that the like 4% that aren't of Mexican descent in these buildings are important to the organization. Therefore, our organization, I would say, is about 95% Latino and 5% Black. It's a small percentage, but it's important to recognize that these divisions exist. For example, when we start organizing in a building and form committees, there are times where the Latino tenant may put down the Black neighbor, right? Or may try to like put the blame and make comments that are derogatory, and therefore this division emerges. And so for our organization, what we feel is essential is to address it. Oftentimes there are organizations that when these sort of divisions happen, not just based on race, but also on gender or sexual orientation, they choose to ignore it. They choose to just focus on the target. In this case, it would be this company owned by Stephen Kessner that we were struggling against. Yet in our organization, we believe it's important to stop what we're doing and to dialogue internally. We've had numerous dialogues internally amongst our membership about what keeps us divided, who benefits from this division, talking about multi oppression that our communities face, and how do we create that change. And so through this process, our leadership emerges with this many times with a new analysis of this problem and are willing to build those bridges. So at this point, we're 3 years old, we're still a young organization, but at this point we have many of our membership that will challenge new members who come with these stereotypes and who may make these stereotypical or derogatory comments regarding our Black brothers and sisters or the gay transgender neighbor. And so we believe it's important that these discussions happen, but that they happen in a more organic way. For example, something concrete happens, like if there's a tenant who's Latino who makes a prejudiced comment about their Black neighbor, then that's organic. So our members that live in those buildings could step up and challenge that. So we believe this is extremely important, and but not just limited to race, also about our gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community, and also regarding gender divisions. For example, there's been times in which some of our leaders who are women come to me and say, my husband no longer wants me to participate. My husband wants me to stay at home, cook, and take care of the children. I really want to continue, but I am no longer going to be able to participate. So we believe that's another example of what keeps us divided, which only benefits the system that's screwing us. So we think it's very important to have these discussions. How do we build these alliances? How do we address these divisions? And concretely, in terms of Black and Latino unity, when we have these discussions, it's not just about talking about it, but it's about finding solutions. But those solutions must come from the community. It must not come from an outsider It has to come from the people, from the ground up. And they have some pretty practical solutions that they've come up with. When we talk about this, they say, well, in our building, when we have a meeting, a committee meeting of tenants, why don't we make it a point that any task that's divided, that's delegated, that a team, a Black and Latino team, come together and basically get the job done together to dispel these stereotypes and to build that unity. So here we have our members brainstorming it out, thinking of ways in which we could address this. There's no formula because a lot of these divisions or prejudice is really deeply embedded in our communities. But if the organization is willing to tackle it firsthand, we believe that the community has the answers. If there's a will, there's a way. And when we did the encuentro, I mean, it's funny because in Boyle Heights the other night, after the discussion, someone came up to me and said, wow, we want to do something here in Boyle Heights too. But, you know, your members are talking about GLBTQ issues in our community as Catholic. If we go and start passing out flyers saying that we're pro-GLBTQ, people aren't going to be down. They're not going to join the organization. So, you know, the response was, this didn't happen overnight. For our members to come to the realization, members that are heterosexual, to come to the realization that we need to build this unity with our GLBTQ brothers and sisters, then it was like more organic. And it was a long process, right? And you still have new members come in with these prejudices, but it's up to the members to challenge that. So we think all of this is very time consuming, but we think it's worth it. We think our members believe that when we talk about, and I said this earlier, our members say, if we are saying publicly that we are an organization that fights for social justice, then we're hypocrites if we're not dealing with this, addressing this, and practicing what we preach. So it was within that spirit that our members very explicitly in the invitation that we sent out regarding the encuentro, you know, we invited the African-American brother and sister that lives in New York City. We invited the GLBT. There was like a very deliberate plan to reach out to those, and 27 groups came. So to us, that was a success. 26 groups came, and to us, that was a success. But this is something that is not going to happen overnight, and it's important to also be conscious of it. We also have, for example, last year, just last year alone, we studied the GINA 6, the racial injustice that took place with the GINA 6 case. We also have studied the Black Power movement. We've also taken the time to talk about, like, our members are mainly Mexican, so we've studied the Young Lords. The Young Lords came out of El Barrio. Right? So we think it's important to also discuss and learn from these other movements and struggle and derive lessons and what went wrong and what went well and what can we apply. And you know, another thing that I think you noticed here, you know, and I know Serena touched upon it, we're deeply inspired by Zapatismo. We're deeply inspired by Zapatismo. We're members of either campaign. And even that, we were just talking about this thing yesterday, that when we as an organization, we formed December of 2004, and it was in June of 2005 when the sixth declaration of the Lacandon Jungle is put out by the Zapatistas. So most of our members, being Mexican or not, they didn't know who the Zapatistas were, or if they knew what the media has been saying, right? That they're narcotraficantes, that they're violent people, etc. So these were the stereotypes that they had about the Zapatistas. And so when they began to study Zapatismo, and when they, more than anything, read the Sixth Declaration, it really resonated with them. So like the members are Mexican, they were able to relate to what was stated in the Declaration, but also those that aren't Mexican in our organization were able to relate to the Cesta Internacional. I'm assuming most of you are familiar with the Sixth Declaration, right? Is that true? Okay. So basically, you know, but it was very organic, right? We still have, like, when new members come into the organization, you know, they're like, what's this? Why are we talking about Zapatismo? What's this other campaign? And so there's this whole process where our members who have been with the organization the longest, right, and understand and decided to become part of the campaign are the ones that are letting the new members know what that struggle is all about and why we're part of it. But a lot of that is very much organic, and it's like, once again, from the ground up. But there's no one set formula. There's no like We can't come here and say, this is the way you do it. You know, this has happened, and it's gradual. It's a slow process, but we believe that it's important. Yes.
Yeah, I appreciate what you're saying, and also the following up on the earlier question. I wonder what were some of the obstacles you faced in doing that outreach to the Black community, because I know the two communities, and having lived in New York and family set in Brooklyn, looking at Harlem, what we back in the day used to call Spanish Harlem,
right
next to the Black community. So I'm wondering, in organizing the Encuentro, what were some of the obstacles you faced in terms of, I know you invited the Black organizations, but what were some of the obstacles you faced or reasons you heard, et cetera, that the organizations either did not participate or, you know, whatever that is, and also that the divisions being played up in the media, the Black and brown divisions, I think is very, very serious nationally. I think it's one of the most serious issues we face as people of color, as people generally, you know, not to exclude what's happening with, you know, the lesbian, gay, trans community, all of that is integral as well. Right. But I'm really worried about the way it's being played up, you know, here in Los Angeles, some of the violence that's happening. And we found also do some work at KPFK Pacifica Radio. And one of the things I proposed to the radio is that we do a series of community meetings in different parts of LA around Black brown unity or Black brown relations or whatever. And there was one over at Cal State LA, which wasn't perfect or whatever, but I found that there was huge interest. I mean, the place was packed down. There were people, you know, outside who really couldn't get in. And another one hasn't happened, you know, since then. There were, you know, problems to work out with that.
Right.
But that kind of open dialogue just about the issue itself of Black brown unity, it seems to me, is something that needs to happen in a very open way. So that I wanted to know what you thought about that, but also what were the specific obstacles. And I'm really worried that the Obama-Clinton thing now is really going to make matters even, like, you know, worse and even lead perhaps to more violence happening in between the two communities. So I think we have to take that very, very seriously as people who are working to change the world in whatever mode, you know, whatever corner of the movement we're in, whether it's at the peace mode or other corners of the movement.
Right. For us, organizing the Encuentro was the first time we kind of stepped out of our neighborhood. The Encuentro took place in October of last year. We started in the December of 2004. So we were approximately like 2.5 years old, and we had gotten a lot of invitations from groups throughout the city to join forces or to form, to be part of coalitions or networks. And we felt we really couldn't do that until we had a base. So, you know, since we began, we felt that we needed to build a base more than anything. It would be too easy to basically make the mistake of just joining all these coalitions and just become eaten up or consumed by this and not have a base. Come to a table, start making decisions without that base. So we felt that our focus had to be below, like los de abajo, right? With those de abajo. And since when we were struggling against Stephen Kessler, the majority of the tenants happen to be Latino, happen to be immigrant. We think that would be needed to be our priority. And so as we were doing this work on the ground, from the ground up at the grassroots level, you know, that battle was 2 years. And we really couldn't branch out until we had a base. So when we decide to actually organize this Encuentro, we really had not built those relationships as of yet, because we felt the time we needed to have a base. At that point, we have 400 members. At that point, we had, I would say, maybe like 300 members. And so we felt we had just reached this major achievement in terms of winning this campaign, and we felt it was time. It was time to externally reach out to everybody. And for us, it was kind of like even like an olive branch, because we always wanted to work with everybody. We just didn't have the time. Most of our members work 6-7 days a week, 10-12-hour days. And the little time they have after work, they want to dedicate to their families. So here we are doing all this planning, having all these plans. Basically, they don't have the privilege, right, to spend a lot of time organizing. So little time they had left, they were basically targeting this Stephen Kessler, going through these like internal discussions about racial divisions, gender, etc. And then it got to the point in which they're like, okay, we're ready now. We're ready to branch out. Keeping, like, knowing that full well our priority is always going to be East Harlem, but we want to make these links and build these bridges. So therefore, the relationships that we had established externally were limited. So we basically gathered like a list of all the groups we could think of that were doing housing works that we knew about and put it out as publicly as possible, ask people to circulate it. So that's kind of what happened. So it was this like a lack of relationship building because, once again, we felt that it was a priority to have a base. So I think that had a lot to do with it. In terms of, I don't know, you were saying that you thought we should, what was that?
I think we should have a chance to just talk about what's going on in Sereno, get a perspective on Sereno, what families are, what struggles taking place here.
Okay.
Spend a moment on that before we get to the proposal on it. That's just my suggestion.
This is the first time we visit El Sereno. Anyone here living in El Sereno that could maybe share a little bit? Okay. Could you share a little bit about what's happening here in terms of gentrification?
Well, I've lived in El Sereno probably for about 26, 27 years, and have really watched, you know, the neighborhood change. So, I mean, for a long time, you know, it was pretty much as it had been. But there was a struggle, I don't remember the name of it. You know, where they were building all those expensive homes, the $750,000. Yeah, Elephant Hill, you know, struggle, you know, which was lost. And even in the area that I live in now, I mean, I could not afford to live in El Sereno now, as, you know, 26, 27 years ago when I first came in. That is how it has shifted in terms of not only property values, but also the rents that are being paid. And it used to be that El Sereno was one of those neighborhoods that you could really, you know, afford to move to and live in. But I find that that is really no longer the case. I mean, if I ever had to move, there's no way that I feel I could really stay, you know, in the neighborhood. And so we've had a big impact here, I think. And in terms of the political class in this neighborhood, you know, they're, you know, as usual, you know, they are on the side of the developers and on the side of people who want to build these, you know, $750,000, $900,000 homes. You don't want to be over in neighborhoods. Who the hell could afford that? So we've had a big issue with it here, but I think there hasn't been the kind of organizing that you're talking about. I mean, the sort of organizing that I've seen is like the kind of neighborhood groups that are concerned about graffiti or crime in the neighborhood, and they want to build relationships with the police and, you know, more right to the right, you know, approach, you know, sort of thing. So the fact that the East Side Cafe, when the East Side Cafe first began here, I mean, we were just so excited because it was the first time of feeling that there's some kind of base or space, you know, in El Sereno for this kind of discussions to happen or even for these points of view. And I've been trying to let, you know, people in the neighborhood that I've known a long time, you know about the work happening here or over with the garden, the El Sereno garden, you know, but it really is a slow kind of process. So I do think that there is certainly the need for that kind of discussion, because a lot of people are really very concerned and very worried about it. And as a lot of the elders, since I've lived there for a long time, now one of the elders in the neighborhood, right? You know, but as a lot of the elders who were there before me are like dying out, and, you know, their properties, they're losing their properties, and, you know, a whole other thing is going on with it. So some of the history is lost. And just one other thing I wanted to say, and I know one of the things they do in Venezuela in terms of the land committees is that they do go into neighborhoods, and people know their neighborhoods very well. They know who are the families in the neighborhoods, who are the elders, you know, what are the housing needs? And it really is that kind of block by block, kind of knowing your neighborhood, you know, plotting out your neighborhood, you know what I mean? Knowing where the empty spaces are, like we have one right next to where we live that's just overrun with rats and, you know, whatever else. You know, so you could take some kind of collective action. So I think that it's ripe for that kind of discussion and really an internal focus in that way, but as Roberto says, to be local without being localized. You know, how that connects with, you know, what's happening in other communities and other countries, struggles in Oaxaca, Venezuela, Bolivia, and other places.
Would someone else like to share?
I don't live in El Cerro, but I work at the Eastside Cafe. So another important thing of El Cerro is that there is a history of mobilization, of engagement of the vecinos, of the neighbors. There's a lot of property owned by Caltrans, the transportation, California transportation, the state transportation agency, because there was this plan to extend the 710 freeway and the vecinos mobilized to stop that, and they did. So Caltrans purchased a lot of property, mostly around Huntington Drive. Like, for example, the garden, the community garden belongs to Caltrans. It's being leased by the neighbors. And many of the Caltrans renters, because they rent out those houses, and according to Roberto, who's one of the renters also, it's a slumlord of Caltrans, because they own, that's how they treat their tenants. And those who have lived for a long time, their houses are falling apart, but the new rents are really, really expensive. Like a duplex across the street behind the garden was running for $1,600 two bedrooms. So it's really, really, really expensive. So we have been talking about this here at the Eastside Cafe. We meet monthly with all the different collectives, and before that we decide what we do collectively. One of the projects that we're thinking about, and I think, Angela, you were part of the committee, was to start talking to the Caltrans renters to start some kind of campaign of awareness of what's going on in El Sereno. Is there anything on that?
No, we're just working on just like a script or something, just what exactly to say to the tenants to get their attention. We're thinking about bringing a video camera or like a still camera to take, you know, pictures of all the things that the Caltrans hasn't been taking care of, and just to get their testimonies and just to get their experiences down. So, and then we wanted to have like a couple of hours out of the day for them to complain about anything that's happened or, I don't know, just anything. So that's what we're working on.
Does anyone else want to share?
Well, you guys know about the eco-village thing that's going on. Have you heard about this?
No.
Well, they want, LAUSD wants to put a local school over there by eco-village, so they want to tear down the whole neighborhood, even though they've gotten a low-income area to work. And they want to put a school in there instead of using the commercial property that's right down the street.
Where is it?
It's on First and Bimini over on the west. Well, it's not the west side. It's central.
It's
by Vermont and Wilshire in Vermont.
The BC Foundation.
Yeah. So, and they even had a council person, Jackie Goldberg, even promised them the property years ago in writing, and they still came in and did this. And you know, and you would think it would be great to put a school in there, but the whole community got up, about 200 people got up and said, "We don't want this here because my kids can take a bus to school," or, you know, local schools are great, but in But to tear apart a neighborhood to do it is wrong, especially when there's, like they say, commercial. There's a car dealership that has plenty of land there to put a school on, and they won't tear down the, they won't take away the commercial interest.
Yes.
Are the one of the things in terms of El Sereno. There's a section. I mean, there's an area in El Sereno that's a Caltrans issue, and then there's over. You know, where there's an industrial area and a lot of factories and polymer plants and that kind of thing. And I read in the newspaper a few years back that one of those plants are emitting cancer-causing agents. And I found when my daughter was coming up at the school bus that quite a few of the kids had either asthma or some kind of respiratory something. We kind of joke that my daughter, who was born in East LA, that her lungs are compromised anyway. But there's a lot of pollution that comes from those areas, sometimes in the water. You know, you get in the shower, and the skin actually itches. There's certain times of day when they're emitting stuff that the whole neighborhood really just stinks. And part of it is because some of those factories provide jobs, you know, for people. You know, there's a thing of if you raise some complaints about the pollution and the fact that people's health, especially the children and the elders, are being greatly compromised, and then that's in, you know, conflict with the employment that's happening. But there's a whole tract of El Sureno, and I don't think that any of the environmental groups or anything has really gone in there and done a study to see how many of those factories are emitting carcinogenics. The place over there by Eastern and Medford, where they have these barrels that were leaking into the ground for, I don't know, like 10 years or something like that. And I'm sure that that was carcinogenic stuff. How much is that is going into the water? So there are a lot of things like that, you know, in the neighborhood that, at least over the end where we are, where people and people's health are being affected by it, people know it. Mm-hmm. You know, but the thing is, like, you know, what the hell do you do about it, kind of thing. So I just wanted to throw in the environmental aspect of it as well.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that because in El Barrio, you know, as here in El Sereno or different neighborhoods in Los Angeles, we're also facing lots of problems simultaneously. And about a year and a half ago, our members decided that it was time to expand, that it was time to tackle multi-issues, knowing full well that the main problem we're facing is gentrification. So inspired by the Zapatistas, we thought that the best way for us to achieve true autonomy and self-determination was to organize a consulta, which we called La Consulta del Barrio, to identify the second issue we would take on and we would tackle simultaneously. We knew full well that we can't take on all of the issues or all the problems that we face in our neighborhood, but we also know that as we grow, we need to tackle at least one more. So a year and a half ago, our members decided to tackle one more. And the way we did it was, at that point we had 280 members, so we felt that we couldn't make the decision without consulting the broader community of East Harlem. So what we did was we created a ballot, a list of the top 8 issues that our community faces. And with that, we actually added a 9th, like an open, like anything that anyone in the community would want to add to that list could be added. And with that ballot, we set up a voting booth at the heart of East Harlem, and we basically stood there. We hit the streets, we stood there asking the people to vote, for the top 3 problems that they face out of this list. And if there was another problem that wasn't named, then to add it to the list. And so we felt that this was the best way to make the decision and allowing the community, everyone's voices to be heard through this process. This was a very time-consuming process. 1,500 community members participated, voted at the voting booth, but at the same time, we knew that wasn't enough. We knew that meant door knocking. We knew that meant like walking the streets, hitting the pavement and asking people to participate, to engage in this. You know, our community was blown away because they weren't used to anyone asking them their opinion, especially the city council member, etc. So this was a whole different way to practice true democracy in our neighborhood. Yet, identifying the top 3 issues still wasn't sufficient. The top 3 issues that were identified by our community were jobs that pay below minimum wage, immigration policy, and the third was problems with the Mexican consulate. So after those 3 issues were identified through this community-wide vote, we had 3 town hall meetings, 1 per issue, to further gauge people's interest level, passion, commitment, and through this entire process, we basically practice self-determination. And very soon, later this year, we're going to announce publicly and launch a new campaign on yet another issue that we're going to tackle. This was a year and a half. People thought we were crazy. Organizations outside the neighborhood were like, that's crazy. Why are you taking all this time to make the decision? Just make it. You have members in the community, but our members were convinced that that wasn't the best way to go, that we needed to consult. So we did la consulta del barrio, and we think it's important as we determine what steps we're going to take as an organization to keep in mind that there's a broader community involved and that we need to always consult the community. One of the proposals that we have for Los Angeles, for the dignified peoples of Los Angeles, was mentioned by one of our compañeras in the video. I don't know if you caught it at the very beginning. She shares some words on behalf of our organization to you here. We have a proposal in which we understand that these divisions that keep us apart is a problem, not just in New York, but everywhere. And we think that in a very humble and simple way, we would like to kind of like contribute our like grain, what's that saying? Our grain of salt, right? By making this proposal to you. We have a proposal here so that hopefully one day you could organize your own Los Angeles Encuentro for Dignity and Against Gentrification. I know that there's a lot of interest in Boyle Heights and different communities that we visited. Even in Oxnard, we were just there the other night for communities to come together. And so I just wanted to share this with you. We also wanted to just briefly let you know that we are now launching this international campaign in defense of El Barrio. This is our new campaign because when we forced this company or this slumlord out of our neighborhood, a multinational corporation out of London bought these 47 buildings. When they bought these buildings, they explicitly stated publicly to the London Times that their goal was to increase rents tenfold, to take advantage of New York City's lax tenant protection laws and to increase our rents tenfold. So in the midst of us celebrating our victory, this company that owns property throughout Asia and throughout Europe, a company that's a multi-billionaire, decided to make their first U.S. real estate purchase in our neighborhood on our turf. That's who we are now battling. This was a year ago when they bought these buildings, and since then, they've aggressively pursued their plan to force us out of our neighborhood. We believe that the only way we're going to be able to be effective in our struggle against this force is to actually build an international campaign, an international network made up of allies and supporters from throughout the world, and that is why we've launched this campaign. The foundational statement of our international campaign we have here, it's the International Declaration in Defense of El Barrio. We're asking groups and individuals from throughout the U.S. to support us as allies, adhering or endorsing our campaign. On April 6th at City Hall, we are going to have a citywide action as part of this campaign, and we wish to announce the 100 groups minimum that have pronounced their support towards our campaign. And there we will also announce that on April 17th, we are going to do a 14-city tour of England and of Scotland. We've been invited to go to Scotland and England to share our struggle, to learn from their struggles there, and to also build this network. Our objective in the UK is to build a strong base of support that will hopefully take action as needed against this multinational company that's based out of London. So please, I don't know if everyone has it. I think it was going to be distributed a while ago. Okay, great. So does everyone have that? There's also a form.
All right, you've been listening to Juan from Movement for Justice in the Barrio. Their website is detodos-paratodos.blogspot.com. detodos-paratodos, paratodos.blogspot.com. detodos-paratodos.blogspot.com. This is Kill Radio, non-corporate, non-soundbite, non-violent empowerment news with DJ SSD. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Send us money. No matter.